Chapter 18 of John, verse 12 all the way through 27. Let's read together. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter stood outside the door. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, I am not. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and in the temple, where all the Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said." When he said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, "You also are not one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" And Peter again denied it, and at once a rooster crowed. May God add his blessing to the reading and the hearing of his word. So as we approach this text, there's a couple things that we want to do first. First, we want to look at the character of Peter, and I'm just going to rattle off some things about Peter. And then we want to look at who Caiaphas is and why Annas is even involved in this story. So this is a confusing text, by the way. In fact, most of the time when we read this text, we like to rearrange it. Because the confusing part about it is not what's actually done in the text. Everybody understands the story. Everybody knows Jesus is going to be crucified. Everybody knows that he's going to be rejected by all people, that people are going to desert him, that he's going to be left alone, that people are going to deny him. Everybody knows these elements of the stories. What doesn't really seem to make sense to our brain is the way they're ordered. You've got this jump from one scene to another, and then back to the other scene. It's back and forth, and it feels a bit like a movie cut, right? It's hard to discern, but I think as we read through it, we'll see what the Apostle John is doing here in setting the story this way. First, remember what we talked about last time, they bind Jesus, right? And how absurd is it that they bind Jesus? It's ridiculous. He just, with a word, saying Yahweh, had them all trapped on the ground. And they have the nerve to try and tie him up. This is a little absurd. So Jesus goes with them willingly. He's not being taken by force, though they think they are taking him by force. He is not overcome. He is not overwhelmed. And so just bear that in mind. None of this catches Jesus off guard. None of it. So Let's think about Peter first. Peter is kind of the leader of the disciples, as we've seen in the Gospel of John. He's the leader of the disciples in every Gospel. He's the first one in the list of all the disciples. He is the loudest, most obnoxious disciple. He's the only disciple who was married that we know of. There may have been another one that was married, but they don't tell us. History doesn't record that for us. But Peter, we know, was married. We know Peter had a mother-in-law that Jesus healed. We know that Peter had a thriving, successful fishing business where he had multiple boats and people who worked for him. We know these things about Peter. He was always answers the question first, often wrong. Peter's the guy that doesn't bother raising his hand when you ask a question. When you say something rhetorical in a sermon, he's the one that answers it out loud. This is Peter. Peter is the only disciple who we know at one point rebuked Jesus. Jesus is talking about his death, and Peter goes, "Hey, you got to stop talking like that. Listen, that's not going to happen." And Jesus in Mark 8:33 tells him, you remember the phrase, the most horrifying phrase to hear from the Savior to you, "Get behind me, Satan." Peter both rebukes the Savior and is rebuked by him and yet stays his friend. He doesn't cower or run away at that rebuke. Peter is a man of fierce loyalty. In the garden, he's the one that pulled the sword ready for action, while the other ones, Mark records, one of the other ones ran off so fast that he left his clothes behind. Peter is bold. He has followed Jesus even into the den of death at this point. Then after the crucifixion and resurrection, in the book of Acts, we see Peter is the leader of the 12. He's the one who talks for all 12 over and over. When Ananias and Sapphira bring their offering to the Lord, and the Lord strikes them down for their deception and their attempt to aggrandize their offering, Peter is the one who addresses them both. Peter is the one who speaks for the church at Jerusalem. Peter is the one who receives the Jewish delegation when they come in to the large congregation, this Jewish delegation that was very culturally important. They go find Peter. Peter is also the one who stands in opposition to Paul at one point. By the way, Peter lost that argument. That's why we're allowed into the church. Just saying. Peter becomes a leader of the Jewish Christians all across the world. He becomes a famous name, so much so that the Catholic Church attempted to usurp his name and call themselves the seed from Peter. And they tried to call him the first bishop of Rome, which is hysterical because if you know anything about Peter's history, he was crucified upside down in Rome after having been caught in Ephesus. So Peter is an amazing character. And yet in this story, all of that we know about Peter is thrown out the window. In this story, we see Peter at his core. We see Peter at his most base. Now let's think just for a second. I want you to be aware of who Caiaphas and Annas are. Caiaphas was the government-appointed high priest. He was clearly a political figure. He was appointed by the local government because they didn't want Annas. Annas had been appointed the high priest and had reigned for several years as high priest. By the way, anytime you say they're reigning as high priest, you've got a problem. So he has ruled and reigned as high priest for several years. He's been the kind of Jewish patriarch of Jerusalem. He is a very prominent name. And Caiaphas is his son-in-law, which means Caiaphas is not part of the blood house of the high priest. He married into it. And he has made political arrangements, and he speaks to the governors quite openly and plainly. And Annas is the one who they take Jesus to. There's a reason for this in the story. You see, Annas represents to the Jewish people pure religion that is undefiled. It is pure Judaism. This is the representative of the Jewish faith. Pure ceremonial Jewishness. This is the religious hierarchy that has been set up. Annas is the Jewish chosen high priest. Caiaphas is the government compromise to keep a rebellion from happening. Caiaphas is a ruler of men. He speaks a prophecy earlier in John about Jesus saying it is better that one man should die than that the whole nation should perish. Not knowing that he is solidly in line with God's plan, he prophesies Jesus' death. He is holy. He is pious. He is wealthy. And he lives in the shadow of his father-in-law. He lives in the shadow of the religious system. Praise the Lord for freedom from religious systems. Or we might all be Caiaphas, clamoring about to find some success on this earth and some praise on this earth while receiving nothing except enslavement to a religious system. So, there's the setting. Those are the characters that you're going to see. And I hope as we go through that this will become clear as to why John has juxtaposed it this way. So verse 13. First they led him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. So they take him to Annas, the Jews' choice for high priest. And they knew, why? You have to ask the question, why are they doing this? And I think there's two reasons. One, Annas is their religious leader. Caiaphas is their politically appointed religious leader. Annas is the actual religious high priest to them. These guys look at the Sanhedrin, the court of the Pharisees, and they go, who's the leader? Annas. They don't go, who's the leader? Caiaphas. They go, who's the leader? Annas. And then if a governing official comes by, they go, yeah, we talked to Caiaphas. So they take Jesus to Annas and they set him before. That's the first reason. The second thing, they know Caiaphas's answer already. Caiaphas has already prophesied that one man should die for the nation. They know what Caiaphas's answer is. Appease the Romans, kill the guy that's claiming to be king. They know what his answer is going to be, so they don't bother with him. Now, pause for a moment, and let's admire the absurdity of the entire situation. The religious leaders attempt to take the master of their religion before their religious leader, so that they can try the God of their religion. Let's say this again. The religious leaders attempt to take the master of their religion in front of their religious leader so that they can try and convict the God of their religion. One more time. The religious leaders take the master of their religion before the religious leader so that they can try and convict the God of their religion. Do you see the absurdity? That was a long way of saying these religious people who worship God are trying to put God underneath their religious system. Do you see the absurdity of this? Now, just a side point in an application. There are many religions today that do this. Some of them claim to be Christian, that try to make God subservient to their dogmas and their laws and their rules. They say, God can't do that because we said this. Good luck with that. Good luck trying to convince God that he can't do something that he wants to do. It's a foolhardy task at best. So just for a moment, think about the absurdity of this. Creation tries to rule over the Creator. The one who is supposed to follow the law tries to rule over the one who wrote it. This is absurd. The one who is subservient to environment tries to command the master of all things who is subservient to nothing. Just for a moment, think about that. Now let's look at verses 15 through 18 here. And we get this first picture of Jesus, of Peter following Jesus. So Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. The other disciple, by the way, we assume is John, because he doesn't refer to himself by name at any point in this book. Although it could have been another one. I think it's probably John because of the first-hand account here and how clear it is. So Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter stood outside at the door. So just pause there and see the privilege that Peter is not given. Peter's the leader of the disciples, and now all his walking with Jesus matters for nothing. All of a sudden, he's in a religious system that he has not climbed the ladder of. And now he's just some random fisherman from Galilee. All his prestige is checked at the door. All his honor is checked at the door. His master has been brought through the door, and he has to stand outside because he's not allowed in. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest, I love how John repeats that, by the way, as if to say, I was known by the high priest. There's a competition going on here a little bit. Right? It's the same competition we see at the resurrection when John writes, I got there, the other disciple got there first and waited outside, but Peter rushed in when he got there. There's this, you feel the tension? There's a little bit of tension here. Peter had this tension, and this should point to us an understanding of Peter's pride at this moment. Being checked at the door while your buddy, who you feel like is second in command when you're first, gets ushered in, there's a little bit of checked pride here. Like, oh no, I'm not in my element. This is not, oh no, I don't have the prestige here that I have everywhere else. So Peter is checked at the door, and the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. So he had to have his friend come get him. And the servant girl at the door said to Peter, you also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? That's an oddly phrased, like the translation there is really weird. I just want you to read it normal. She looked at him and goes, aren't you one of his? That's basically what she says. There's no subtext here. This is just a flat out question. There's no danger for him to answer yes. The disciple, the other disciple who she knew was one of the disciples most likely, came and got him. Like they're not hunting him at this point. Not yet. They're not pursuing him. He is not the one on trial here. Jesus is on trial. In fact, if anything, she was asking so that he could stand witness for Jesus. And that's about it. They're not after him. They're after Jesus. And he gets asked the question, aren't you with this man? Aren't you one of his? Like, I'll take you further in, almost as if to say, I'll take you further in if you are. And Peter is given the first opportunity to identify himself as separate from the religious system, as different, as holding allegiance somewhere else. And he answers them. He answers her, I am not. Again, no subtext there. This is not, there's nothing you can do to dance around in Greek here and go, what he really meant was. No, this is straight up. No. I'm not. A flat answer for a flat question. And then we have this setting. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold. Whenever John tells you what the temperature is, it's rather important. So there's two things going on here. the light of the world that brings life and warmth is on trial. And the religious leaders are trying to stamp him out. That's the first thing that's going on here. The light of the world that brings life and warmth into life is on trial, and they're trying to stamp him out. Second thing going on here is they're trying to tell you there's a crowd, and they're gathered in one place. And Peter is standing next to them, warming himself by their light. So the light of the world that brings life and warmth is on trial in the other room. But the religious officers, did you notice it said officers? Religious officers have made their own fire. Remember what we saw when the absurd scene happened, when they brought to go arrest Jesus? They come at night and they carry torches, and they carry their own fire, their own flame to light their own path, to arrest the light of the world. Same thing's going on here. They've made their own fire to try and warm themselves. And where is Peter in the midst of this fire? He's standing with them, right next to them, warming himself in the false warmth that they have made. So this is the setting. He has denied himself first. And before we move any further into the story, I just want to ask a few questions. The first one being, when has there ever been a time in your life when you have favored safety and comfort over the gospel? If we're honest, we would all have at least one where we've said, I clammed up and favored my own comfort and security over the gospel. Another question to ask ourselves might be, has there ever been a point in our time when we were checked at the door and out of our element, and it seemed like all of a sudden we couldn't do anything, and we were just left with no authority or power or anything, and all of a sudden we were out of our element in an awkward place, and we have that weakness in your hands? You know what I'm talking about? When anxiety starts to rise up and your hands don't quite seem to work, and you have to eat and sit around people who are very uncomfortable with you, or talk with people who you're very uncomfortable being around, and you really don't know what to say, and you just wish somebody would swoop in and eliminate everything and you could go home back to your comfortable place. Has there ever been a time when you've been there? Because that's where Peter is. You see, we can all relate to this story. We can all relate to this posture Peter is in, where there's anxiety rising up within us, and oh no, what if they catch me? What if I don't know what to say? I can't fix this. Oh no. We've all been there when we felt alone. I'm going to let those questions linger while we read. You're welcome. Verses 19 through 24. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Just note real quick about the question. The questions we know from the other gospels, these are vague questions. They've had false witnesses brought before them. They've had people saying things that aren't true about Jesus. These are vague questions the high priest asks. He doesn't ask specifics. He asks in general, tell me your teaching and tell me about your disciples. What are you doing? Are they all carrying weapons? These are vague, big, general questions. He doesn't ask any specifics about when Jesus said X, Y, Z. Instead, he asks general questions about his teaching. And Jesus answered him there in verse 20, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. So the first attack is on Jesus' general depiction of who he is. And I just want to encourage you, if you are ever under attack by the adversary, he deals in generalities. He likes to deal in generalities because then there's room to play. Case in point, they don't like me. Who's they? I used to deal with this all the time. Teenagers deal with this all the time. They deal with this all the time. And I was a youth pastor for 11 years thereabouts. And literally every month there was somebody that they don't like me. Or they said this. And you'd have to drill them down. Who is they? Well, and they don't want to tell you. Well, they don't. They're just everybody. Who is everybody? Well, the whole group. Who's the whole group? And then eventually you get to it. Somebody like, well, it was Cindy. Okay, so let's rewind and replace they, everybody, whole group with Cindy. And then we can deal with the problem. This is the way the adversary works. He wants you to think that generally everything is wrong. He wants you to think that because you're in this one particular area where the officers of the Jews are, where the people are gathered around a small fire pit and it's the only place you can get warmth, he wants you to think that that's it. That there's this general attack on who you are. And Jesus hears the attack and answers it. You see, the adversary deals in generalities. And Jesus responds protecting the generalities. He says, I didn't hide anything, which is an interesting thing to say for a man who back in Mark chapter 4 was asked, why do you speak in parables? And he said, so they'd be always seeing but never understanding, always perceiving but never grasping. Jesus says that, by the way. Why do you speak in parables? He says, well, for you it's to know the kingdom of heaven, but for them it's so they won't understand. Okay. But Jesus calls the guy to specifics. He says, I haven't hidden anything. I've spoken openly. You can ask people what I said. I imagine the high priest going, yeah, but nobody understands what you said. Well, you don't understand because you don't believe. Right? It's that simple. It really is that simple. You won't understand something you're unwilling to believe. And so it's that simple. Jesus said, I haven't hidden anything. And he basically responds, if I was to rephrase this response, he'd say, give me specifics. I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in the synagogues. Ask them what I said. In general, just ask them what I said. Ask people who heard me what I said. Because you have a specific question, I'll answer it. Jesus responds by saying, I've lived openly. Question whatever you want. What do you want to question? This is the application for us here would be when the enemy attacks us with generalities, force specifics. I struggle, a lot of you know I struggle a little bit with anxiety. Not severely, but I have some. And I will sit down and I will have to write out specifics when I have that dark night of the soul or that weakness in the moment where everything feels like it's going to collapse around me, I will sit down and write out the specifics. And that helps me go to Scripture with the specifics. What is the specific issue? Jesus is drawing them to give me specifics. He says, ask those around me. If we have nothing to hide, the people will have heard it. This is the reason that we're open with everything we do as Christians, that we live a life of transparency, that we let people see our weaknesses. This is the reason that you have leaders in this church who are willing to tell you all our flaws, who are willing to look at you and go, we're not good at that. We have believed that if we have nothing to hide, the adversary has nothing to attack. But Peter, back in that courtyard, has something to hide, doesn't he? Or so he thinks. He needs a perspective change. But we'll see that in a minute. So Jesus calls him, says, ask those around me. And the officer then there in verse 22 strikes him, hits him, right? I imagine in the back of the head or in the shoulder, something that would make him fall to his knees. Hard enough to actually make him hurt. I love Jesus' response to this. It's almost irritation. Like, come on! Like when my kid is mad at me and strikes me in the arm. Boom! Stop it. Right? This is almost an irritated response. You see what Jesus says there in verse 23? If what I've said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I've said is right, why did you hit me? That's his response. Why are you hitting me? Are you kidding? This is goofy. You don't even have an accusation yet. Jesus responds with this interesting response. And his response doesn't make sense unless you realize what's actually going on. Unless you realize that this is God incarnate and that just a few moments ago he had a band of soldiers face down on the ground at his very voice. I mean, unless you realize that, this scene doesn't make sense. Criminals don't look at the high priest and go, why don't you ask the people around me what I said? Because it's offensive, it's dangerous. That high priest can sentence you to death. But if it's God standing there, and he says, look around and see the wondrous works that I have done. If it's God, this makes perfect sense. And then they hit him. And all the power of creation and the majesty of God and the strength that comes with that, bound up in this single man who could cause the earth to crack in two at his very voice. And indeed, in just a chapter from now, his death is going to cause the earth to tremble and shake, and a veil will be torn from top to bottom that no man can reach without the aid of ladders. And the sky is going to darken, and everything will shut down, and graves will open, and the earth will go insane. All that power, and he does nothing. Now it makes sense for him to look at him and go, why'd you hit me? Can't you see that I am holding the very air you breathe? That I am holding your molecules together, and yet you hit me? In the context of this God, power under control, he stands there looking at his high priest, the high priest of the religion he rules. He says, charge me with something. In a way, it's the same conversation that God has with Job. When Job says, let God come and I will question him. By the way, never do that. Bad idea. And God shows up in a hurricane and blasts Job into terrifying oblivion. And then in mercy and grace restores it. Same conversation here. God stands before the Prince of Man and goes, why'd you hit me? Remember, Jesus isn't caught off guard by any of this. He's not shocked that he was hit. He's not surprised at the behavior of the high priest. He's not even surprised that Caiaphas isn't the one that's asking him, but it's Annas. He's not surprised at any of this. Instead, Jesus knows all of this stuff is happening. This isn't surprising for him. But for Peter, he has forgotten who he serves. And in this moment, in his dark moment, we get to watch his response. Verse 25. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. Remember, he's warming himself by the fire. So they said to him, "You also are not one of his disciples, are you?" They ask again. Aren't you one of his? Aren't you? You're one of his, right? There's no pretext here. They're looking like, hey, shouldn't you be inside at the trial? If you're one of his, shouldn't you be in there? What's going on? Why are you out here? We need to take you to the right place. They're not looking to lynch him. And Peter, then it says, he denied it and said, "I am not." And one of the servants of the high priest, a relative, I love this. God put Peter in such an awkward position here. Peter has the opportunity to remember that the God of the universe is on his side. There's no fear when you remember that. Because whatever they do to you doesn't matter. Because to live is Christ, to die is gain. Right? And so, the relative, God has the foresight to put a relative, a cousin, of the guy whose ear was cut off by Peter in the crowd. He's like, "Hey, didn't you cut off my cousin's ear? I saw it. I was there." And Peter again denied it. And at once a rooster crows. Now remember back at dinner, Peter says, "I will never deny you, Lord. I will be here for you forever." You can imagine him pulling out his sword. "I've got this." And Jesus, remember what he said. "I tell you, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So Peter is sitting or standing around this fire with these men, warming his hands in the most anxious and despairing place of his life. His pride and arrogance and authority have been checked at the door, and all that is left is the base Peter. All that is left is preserve my life, Peter. There's no confidence, no strength of arms, no disciples around him to look to him to lead. It's just him. And he's asked a harmless question, and he says, "No, I don't know Jesus." And we can look at Peter and call him a coward all we want, but we do the same thing. You see, Peter has forgotten something. He has forgotten what we see in Jesus in that room. He has forgotten that the Creator of all things is standing in front of a high priest that he put there, that he's in sovereign control over, and that all the power in the world is held in his hands. And when he is struck by the high priest officer, he does not respond for one reason. He doesn't want to. And he holds all the strength of humanity and life itself. And Peter has forgotten that and has sought warmth and tried to hide himself. It's funny about this is the way Jesus solves this problem for us. Because it would be a tragedy at this moment to let you just linger here and go, "Hey, all right, come back next week." Instead, I want you to jump ahead to John 21. So if you got your Bible, look at John 21. You see, Peter is caught in that moment, and he fails. Three times he fails. He spends the rest of this gospel trying to make it up, so much so that he's the first one to run into the tomb. He's the one that is like, "Oh, we got to be doing something. We got to go do something." And Jesus isn't there. And he's like, "I'm going fishing." And he goes fishing with his buddies because he's like, "I have to do something with my hands." Right? And Peter, when Jesus shows up on the shore, Peter jumps out of the boat and swims to Jesus to get there first. And then everybody else brings the ship, and you get this snarky response from the other disciples like, "We had to bring in all the fish ourselves because Peter, that dummy, jumps off the boat." And so you get this picture. And then when they come to the shore, remember what it says. Peter runs over to the net and drags the net of fish by himself to Jesus. As if to say, "I'm still the leader. I'm still the guy that can do this.
I'm still the one. I'm your guy, Jesus. I'm still the guy. I'm still the guy. That rooster means nothing. And all this anxiety swells up within him, and he's worried that the sovereign Lord of all creation has decided he's not fit for office. He feels like he's been benched. Does that make sense? Feels like he's been benched. He was the star point guard, and now he's on the bench. That's what he feels like, but it's not true. So, Jesus, what would you expect? Let's just think about this for a minute. Before you look at John 21:15 and following, what would you expect? Some of you want to look at John 21:15. Go ahead. What would you expect Jesus to do? You'd expect him, you know, to hug Peter, maybe? Buddy, it's okay. You expect him to, I don't know, get Peter a copy of Genesis? I got you this. Go and teach it. No, I don't know. You'd expect him to get him a nice leather bracelet and tell him, buddy, you're still the rock. Have the rock inscribed on it, right? Encouragement, you know. Just want to tell you, if you thought any of those, you're going to be wrong. I was giving you wrong answers on purpose. What Jesus does with Peter is he sits down and he makes him food, cooks him a meal. And then after the meal is over, this happens. John 21, verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Points at the fish. He's talking about the fish. You love me more than the fish? More than these miracles I do? Peter said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He says to him again, feed my lambs. So Peter answers, yes, Lord, I love you. And Jesus says, feed my lambs. Next verse, verse 16. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, then tend my sheep. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him a third time, do you love me? And Peter answered, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. You see, in our darkest hours, when we have failed the Lord, when we have dropped everything, when we have let anxiety overcome us, and when we have lost all hope of significance, Jesus' answer is not to coddle us and say, it's going to be okay, and put his arm around you and go, though he does that, don't get me wrong, though he does that, Jesus' answer in our desperate need for validation is to point us to the mission of the gospel. Feed my sheep. Get busy about the work of the gospel. And I think there's a reason for this. You see, Peter was so consumed with what had happened before that he couldn't think about what he's supposed to do. So consumed with the things that had gone on previously, the failures that he had given into, that he couldn't think about what he was supposed to do. So Jesus reminds him. He asks him three times. How many times did Peter deny? Three. How many times did Jesus give him a do-over? Three. He asks him three times. There's some more interesting stuff about this passage, but we're not going to look at that today. We'll look at that when we get to it in a month or two. But Jesus asks him three times and reminds him, get about the work. You have a job to do. You have a mission. And I'd ask you, what else could the sovereign creator of all things say to you in your darkest hour, to bring you hope and purpose, then feed my sheep. There's nothing else he could say. That is the single greatest thing that God could do to draw you out of despair. To look at you and go, I have a reason for you. I have a purpose for you. I want you to get to work because I want you to be used for the kingdom. Feed my sheep. God calls Peter, says, feed my sheep. And then there in verse 18 through 19, he gives this cryptic phrase to Peter. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death Peter was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. See, in the dark nights of our soul, when we have been checked at the door, when all our self-confidence is gone, when there is nothing left and we stand surrounded by people we think are enemies, warming ourselves in false religion fire, and we're afraid to speak, we need to remember this. The God of all creation has found value in your work feeding his sheep. The God of all creation has decided to empower and equip you and surround you with what looks like adversaries so you might proclaim the gospel. Peter has multiple other chances in the story. In the book of Acts, he has multiple other opportunities to share the gospel. One comes to mind when they're locked in a room and the Spirit descends and lands on them. And Peter is the one who opens his mouth and looks at all the Jewish people and says, you twisted and crooked generation, repent and believe. And he calls them to turn from their ways. He accuses everybody in a crowd of thousands of Jewish people. He accuses all of them of being the murderers of the Messiah. That is boldness. And that is a boldness unheard of until this point. When Jesus points to him, and in his despair and desire to be loved and held on to and taken care of, he is told, feed my sheep. Follow me. So on those dark nights of the soul, when we fail the way Peter had, when we break and we aren't able to accomplish what we've been sent to do for whatever reason, when we freeze in the face of adversity, rest in the fact that you serve a glorious God, a glorious God who is the living embodiment of power under control in Jesus. And no matter who surrounds you, or what darkness may seem to overtake, the victory has been won in Jesus Christ. And he calls you to one thing to remember. Feed my sheep. Follow me. Let's pray. Then we'll enter into a time of communion.